recall that we were talking about chemical bonds, the two major kinds of chemical bonds that we're talking about in this course are what? Ionic and covalent. What qualifies them as chemical bonds? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Metal, non-metal?
No, that's what's involved in an ionic bond. But any given bond is either a chemical bond or not. What makes a bond that is a chemical bond? No, that makes it a covalent bond. A chemical bond is a bond that produces new stuff when that bond is formed. The substance is different now. As we'll see today, that's not true for all bonds. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But ionic bonds and covalent bonds are both chemical bonds because if they form, then you no longer have the stuff you started with. That bond formation creates new substance, like sodium chloride instead of sodium and chlorine individually. Well, we ended last time talking about covalent bonds, and remember that the co part of the word covalent means sharing. This slide 13 is a visual way of telling you something I've already told you, namely that a single covalent bond never is made up of a single electron, right? Because for there to be covalent sharing, each of the two involved atoms is sharing an electron. For two total electrons being shared, or one pair, we can see this explicitly if we represent the formation of a covalent bond between hydrogen atoms to form a hydrogen molecule with Lewis dot diagrams. And so remember that, well, I shouldn't say remember because we haven't talked about this yet, but a Lewis dot diagram is a way to represent an atom and some of its electrons. So you start a Lewis dot diagram by writing the chemical symbol for whatever kind of atom you're talking about. For hydrogen, it's H. That represents the nucleus of the atom, where the protons and any neutrons are going to be. And then to represent electrons, you use dots, but only valence electrons are ever indicated in a Lewis dot diagram. Well, a hydrogen atom has only one electron, and its only electron is also a valence electron. So we put a dot there. Similarly for the other hydrogen, it doesn't matter which side of the H you put a dot. There's one electron there, right? What is the valence shell of hydrogen? No, I said, what's the valence shell? Shell 1, the first energy level, correct. And how many sub-shells are in shell 1? 1, the S subshell. How many orbitals? No, just one. The S subshell contains a single S orbital called the 1S orbital, right? Meaning that entire shell consists of a single orbital. Therefore, this dot, the electron that hydrogen has, is just one of two total, two maximum, that the whole shell can hold, right? But it's also one half filled orbital, the 1s orbital. And that's why this hydrogen is not content. Or the fact that its shell is not full is why this hydrogen is not content like helium is. Similarly, identically, for the other hydrogen. And that's why the deal is struck between them for each of them to share its one with the other so that they both get credit for both electrons, the pair. And if you draw that as dots, you can see that two electrons being shared, which are going to be spend some time around each of the two atomic nuclei, are what form the single covalent bond. And you can draw it as two dots, or you can also draw it as a line between them. One line or a dash between symbols represents two electrons. All right? But look at oxygen. Oxygen is element number 8. How many electrons does it have? 8. But there aren't 8 dots here. How many valence electrons does it have? No. 6. What is its valence? Yes, that's 2. Because it requires 2 more, in addition to those 6 it has, to bring it to the situation that shell 2 is full, which happens to hold 8 total electrons, because unlike shell 1, shell 2 has 4 orbitals in it, right? A 2s plus 3 different 2p's for a total of 4 orbitals, and therefore a maximum of 8 electrons that the shell can hold. When 2 atoms come into contact and have the at least the capacity to interact with each other, it's the valence shells, not the non-valence, more inner shells that come into contact, right? So it's the valence electrons in the outer shells that get rearranged in any chemical reaction. That's why we don't bother drawing dots for non-valence electrons in the Lewis dot diagram. That's why oxygen only has 6 dots. There are 6 valence electrons. And you can see that because it's 6th from the left in its period. Right? The other 2 are in the first shell. The other 6, to get to oxygen, are valence electrons. Okay, so here you have dots drawn on 4 sides of oxygen. The proper way of doing this is to always start with the symbol for the nucleus. This is an oxygen atom. And like I said, you deal only with valence electrons, so you have to determine how many that is. We just said it's 6. Well, the valence shell, though, is what? What is the valence shell for oxygen? Shell 2, right? And shell 2 has 4 orbitals. So when you start distributing electrons, you do it 1 electron per orbital until you run out of orbitals. Here you have 4 orbitals to work with, so you put a dot individually on all 4 sides. The 4 sides represent 4 orbitals here. You haven't listed all the valence electrons, though. So then you start doubling up until you run out of electrons. And that's the electron, or the Lewis dot diagram for oxygen. Notice that 2 of these orbitals are full. These are paired electrons that are not going to be shared for that reason. Each of these pairs, these 4 total electrons, are going to remain the permanent property of oxygen. It's the ones that are in half-filled orbitals that give this oxygen instability compared to neon at the right edge. And so the half-filled orbitals, those electrons are going to be the ones that will be involved in sharing, so that in that deal, the oxygen will get credit from the other oxygen, for the other atom, for the shared electron that atom is giving. And it will seem like these are both filled. In this case, the other atom is another oxygen. So the 2 unfilled orbitals are the ones that are involved in sharing, and that involves each oxygen sharing 2 electrons rather than just 1. So there are 2 pairs, 4 overall electrons, making up what we call a double covalent bond. It counts as 2, but we say it is a double covalent bond. That involves 4 electrons, though. And just as a single covalent bond is much stronger than an ionic bond, a double covalent bond is even stronger than a single covalent bond, and therefore harder to break. It is more stable. The molecule is more stable because of that, because it's harder to break. There's even the possibility, depending on the atoms involved, of a triple covalent bond. Well, if you look at nitrogen, how many valence electrons does it have? Five. What is the valence shell? No. Two. It's shell two is the valence shell. Right? That's the outer shell in the case. It's the same period as oxygen. So its outer shell is level two, or shell two. What is the valence? Three. It requires three more to get to eight. It's three steps from the right edge. But you do it the same way. You start with the nitrogen nucleus. You have five, in this case, electrons you need to distribute over four orbitals. So you start with four individual ones, and then you double up one and you're done because you've run out of electrons. These three unfilled orbitals are the ones that are going to be involved in sharing. So any nitrogen atom that's going to be part of a molecule is going to make three bonds. The valence can be thought of as how many covalent bonds that atom needs to make with other atoms in order to be satisfied. So in any molecule that nitrogen's part of, it's making three total bonds. But if it comes together with another nitrogen, those two alone can form a triple covalent bond, which is six electrons being shared. And that is the strongest covalent bond. And this has biological significance, by the way, because all organisms absolutely require nitrogen in order to exist. Doesn't make sense to even talk about organisms without nitrogen, because of the four biological macromolecules that we named earlier. Two of those, proteins and nucleic acids, require nitrogen. They include nitrogen in their composition. Well, there are no organisms without DNA or proteins. So every organism vitally requires nitrogen. But even though we are bathed in nitrogen because we live in on land and there's air all around us, which is almost entirely nitrogen, we can't use directly any of that nitrogen. We can't exist without the nitrogen, but we can't use it in that form because we can't break that triple bond. And almost nothing that's alive can, even though all living things need the nitrogen. This is just one of several reasons why we can't exist without bacteria, because only certain bacteria and nothing else is able to break that triple bond to make the nitrogen available in different compounds so that the rest of the living things can exist. But those are multiple covalent bonds. Just keep in mind, every individual covalent bond is two. It's a pair of shared electrons. 14 gives you different representations of bonding. There's really not any new information here. I've already told you that instead of using two dots, you could represent it as a dash. That means the same thing. One dash means two electrons. The electron distribution diagrams are kind of nice until you get the hang of it, because it uses these rings that we talked about before as being shells, including their dots. Well, by overlapping the shells, you can see that when you get to oxygen, that there are some pairs that are going to remain oxygen's property, that one atom's property, and there are others that are going to be shared with the other atom, just like I was talking about over here. And the space-filling molecules look nice when they're computer-generated, but they don't really give you much information. All right, let's go on to 15 now. This is a water molecule, or a representation of a water molecule. And water has a lot of different special properties. So many special properties that we devote a whole chapter to it coming up next. And those properties are why we are able to exist, not humans, but living things in general. We owe our existence to the special properties of water. In other words, there is no life without water. And that's why when we search for extraterrestrial life, we haven't found it yet, but when we search for it, it really amounts to using techniques to figure out whether those planets have water on them. If they don't, we just move on, because without water, there's not life. Well, all of the special properties that we'll talk about in the next chapter really spring from the fact that water is an example of a polar compound. So I need to define some things here. First of all, water is a molecule, and what does that tell you about its bonds? It does, but it tells you something even more specifically than it's a chemical bond. Covalent. If these were ionic bonds, this wouldn't be a molecule, remember. Salts do not form molecules. Right? Molecules are predefined sizes because the bonding is covalent. So only molecules have covalent bonds. And it's a compound because it's made out of two or more different elements, right? Whereas an oxygen molecule is still a covalent substance, but it's not a compound because it's still just pure oxygen. Well, if once you realize or determine for any given substance that the bonds are covalent rather than ionic, then, well, that's the dichotomy of chemical bond types, ionic and covalent, the two big groups. But once you determine that you're dealing with a covalent bonding, then there are two subdivisions of covalent bonds, two categories. And those are polar and nonpolar, or polar covalent bonds and nonpolar covalent bonds. And correspondingly, if a molecule features polar covalent bonds, then we say the whole molecule is polar. Whereas if it contains only nonpolar covalent bonds, the whole molecule is nonpolar. But what does it mean, polar versus nonpolar? Well, the word polar is used in different ways in science, depending on the situation. But polarity always refers to the fact that there are two parts that differ in some respect, like the North and the South poles. The Earth is polar for that reason. Well, a covalent bond is polar based on the distribution of electrical charge. All right? Now remember, we're talking about, for polar and nonpolar, those are still both subdivisions of covalent bonds. So we're not talking about ionic bonds at all here. A covalent bond, any given covalent bond, is either polar or nonpolar. But also by definition of being covalent, any covalent bond involves a sharing rather than a transfer of electrons, right? So in both of these categories, polar and nonpolar covalent bonds, there is a sharing of electrons. How they're shared is different, though. And in real-life situations involving sharing, you've probably experienced that not every sharing situation involves absolutely equal sharing, right? Someone might be sharing a little bit more than the other. And that also applies to bonding, covalent bonding. And so this, what determines how fair or equal the sharing is going to be depends on a property called electronegativity. There is a value for electronegativity for each of the elements. But electronegativity is how strongly a given atom wants those electrons for itself, how greedy it is with respect to electrons, in a sense, is the electronegativity. And the higher the numeric value for electronegativity, the more greedy that atom is. So yes, it will say, I'll share, but it will end up trying to keep those electrons for itself more than an atom that doesn't have as high an electronegativity. It is the tendency for an atom to keep electrons for itself. Now, the trend is not perfect on the periodic table, but more or less, the values for electronegativity are low in the lower left, for atoms in the lower left, and then they get bigger and bigger as you go up to the upper right, except for the noble gases, which don't want to have anything to do with anyone, right? They're not interested in sharing their electrons, because they're happy. So look where the most extreme one is. That's fluorine, right? It's not a noble gas, but it's in the upper right-hand corner besides that. And it has the highest electronegativity of all the elements. A close second, though, is oxygen right next door. It's almost all the way up there in the right upper right as well. Hydrogen, on the other hand, has a much lower value. And keep in mind that hydrogen is a non-metal, right, even though it's over there by itself. And we're talking about molecules here, so what kind of things are involved in molecules? What kind of atoms? What makes up molecules? Yes, but more specifically, what kind of atoms? No. I mean, yes, but not just any. Well, what kind of bonds make up molecules? And what kind of atoms are involved in covalent bonds? No, those aren't atoms. What kind of atoms? Nonmetals, right? An ionic bond is made between a metal and a nonmetal. A covalent bond is made between two nonmetals, including hydrogen. So, you know, that water has hydrogens in it, but hydrogen, remember, is a nonmetal, like the rest of them that are in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, but anyway, hydrogen's electronegativity value, which you can look up, and by the way, if you've never been to ptable.com, that is by far the best periodic table I've ever seen. It's a pretty cool website. You can look up these values, but it's lower, quite a bit lower than it is for oxygen. Oxygen is greedy with respect to sharing its electrons. And so, whenever you have a situation when two atoms, two nonmetals forming a covalent bond get together, and those two atoms have quite a bit of a difference numerically between their values of electronegativity, then the sharing is going to end up being unequal. It's still sharing, but the atom that has the higher electronegativity is going to want those electrons for itself more than the other does. And so in that sharing, that pair of electrons is going to end up spending more time around the higher electronegativity nucleus, that atom, than it is around the other nucleus, the other atom. Right? So it's still sharing, it's just unequal sharing. And if that happens, then it's not just a covalent bond, it's more specifically a polar covalent bond. That happens twice in a single water molecule. There are two identical bonds, right? Two bonds, one between oxygen and one hydrogen, the other between that same oxygen and the other hydrogen. But look at it from just the perspective of a single bond here. In this one bond on the left, oxygen has a much higher electronegativity than hydrogen. It's more greedy. So the shared pair of electrons between these two atoms spends more time around this oxygen than around this hydrogen. And think about what electrons are. They are particles that carry a negative charge. So wherever the electrons are, that makes that place partially negative, more negative than it was without them, right? Does that not make sense? Electrons are carrying negativity, negative charge. So where they are is negative. But this is not a transfer of electrons permanently like it is for an ionic bond. So ions have full charge, a full plus one or a full minus one if one electron is transferred. Here we have partial charges denoted by a lowercase delta, Greek alphabet's version of a D. So delta minus means a negative partial charge. Delta plus means a partial positive charge. Why partial negative on the oxygen? Because it's greedy, and that's where the electrons end up being more often than not. And since they're not very often at the hydrogen end of that same bond, that means the hydrogen end is slightly positive because there aren't electrons to counteract the proton's charge here as often. So you see why it's positive for hydrogen? It's always going to be partially positive for the atom that has the lower electronegativity. It's always going to be partially negative for the atom that has the higher electronegativity. Now, it should make sense to you, based on all of this, that you're only ever going to have a polar covalent bond if the two atoms involved are different kinds of atoms. Consider an oxygen molecule. It's made up of two oxygen atoms, right? I just told you that oxygen has one of the highest electronegativities of all elements. So in an oxygen molecule, each oxygen atom is greedy as hell. But they're equally greedy as hell. So neither of them wins out. And the two electrons get, or the four electrons in the case of oxygen, end up being equally shared. So there isn't a partial positive or a partial negative in that molecule. It's a nonpolar molecule because it's a nonpolar covalent bond. Is that all clear?
So both hydrogen and oxygen are both greedy with the electrons?
No. They are greedy to an extent, but oxygen is much greedier than hydrogen because of the high electronegativity. So this happens sometimes when there's different atoms, but sometimes you have two different elements, two different atoms, that even though they are different atoms and technically speaking they don't have exactly the same electronegativity values, if they're really close to each other in value, then effectively it will be nonpolar. It will be effectively equal sharing. Yeah.
So with that whole process that you're explaining, I don't mean to sound like a smartass, but like, why is that important, and how do we observe that by the naked eye? That way we can understand what's going on molecularly in that smaller level. Is there anything we can see big picture as to have a better understanding as to why that's happening and why that's important to learn?
Yeah, for the rest of today and part of the next time. Okay. We're going to see several examples.
I don't know if you had anything off the top of your head you could throw out.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's in the next slide.
Okay.
Well, actually, not the next slide, but it's coming. There's going to be plenty of examples today. Okay, well, and I'm glad you say this because it's impossible to overstate the importance of this. If water were not polar, none of us would exist. Life would not exist because of all the special properties that water has because it's a polar molecule. And that's when the examples will eventually come in, mostly in the next chapter, which I'll start pretty soon because we're almost done with this chapter. But in slide 16, we can see the molecular significance of this. You know, that previous slide was just a single water molecule. And we can now that we know why, as an individual molecule, it is polar, namely simply because the bonds that are included in that molecule are themselves polar covalent bonds. We call the whole molecule polar for that reason. It doesn't mean much if you just consider a single molecule. But you never have that situation except on a slide, right? You have trillions and trillions of water molecules next to each other. Well, here we have two for simplicity. And these happen to be different molecules, obviously, right? Ammonia on the bottom and water on the top. They wouldn't have to be, though. Could be two waters, two ammonias, anything. As long as the point here is that they're both polar molecules. They're made up of polar covalent bonds. In ammonia, ammonia is polar for the same reason water is. The atoms involved in its covalent bonds differ substantially in the values for their electronegativities. Nitrogen isn't quite as high as oxygen, but it's not far behind. It's still much higher than hydrogen's value. And therefore, the sharing of electrons is unequal between nitrogen and hydrogen, just like it is unequal for oxygen and hydrogen. And similarly, the nitrogen wins out, just like the oxygen wins out, with respect to custody of the electrons. And the nitrogen end of each bond is slightly negative, whereas the hydrogen end is slightly positive. It's exactly the same situation. It's due to differences in electronegativity values. But when you have multiple polar molecules in proximity to each other, they don't ignore each other like nonpolar molecules would, because those partial charges means they're going to have slight attraction to each other, just like ions have an even stronger attraction to each other due to their difference in charge. One is positive, one's negative, right? So when two polar molecules encounter each other, they will swivel. Just like if you have two magnets get close together, they will turn on their own, align themselves. And the polar molecules swivel in such a way that the partially negative end of one molecule is situated next to the partially positive end of the next, because of that attraction between positive and negative. Now, this is an example of a bond, and specifically it's called a hydrogen bond. Even though hydrogen doesn't have to be involved, it just usually is, because there's hydrogen just about everywhere in molecules. And because hydrogen has a fairly low electronegativity, so it's often involved. It doesn't have to be, though. That's just why they were called that. But a hydrogen bond, you can tell by the name of it, is a bond. It is not a chemical bond, though. Because when this forms, you don't have new stuff. You still have water and ammonia. You haven't turned it into anything new. But unlike two molecules that are nonpolar, they actually are attracted to each other, at least momentarily, while they're close to each other. And in a population of polar molecules, that means there is a little bit more order in that population than there would be in a more random population of nonpolar molecules. Does all that make sense? Okay. Let's go on to 17 then. Just a couple of slides left in this where we kind of change directions momentarily, and then we'll have a whole chapter on the specialness of water. 17, though, shows you a couple molecules, including water, that we've already looked at. And you might have wondered why the water was drawn this way with hydrogens both on one side of the oxygen rather than straight across. You might have predicted that a water molecule would naturally align itself so that the hydrogens are on the two opposite poles of the oxygen, but that's not how it is. It's a bent molecule. And here, to make sense of this, you think back to the Lewis dot diagram I drew for oxygen, which is right up here. Its valence shell, right, is 2, which contains 4 orbitals represented by the 4 sides here. Well, those 4 orbitals are actually trying to become as far apart from each other as possible. Because the orbitals have electrons in them, all electrons are negatively charged. Well, like charges repel each other. So the orbitals are trying to space themselves out from each other as much as possible, with oxygen at the center. And if you imagine trying to do that with four things, the way that you space four things out as much as possible compared to a center is to form a tetrahedron, the four corners of a tetrahedron. And that, for the gaming nerds, is the four-sided die. It has four corners, right? Those are maximally spaced out. If you put those corners in any, if you move any corner, it's going to have to get closer to another corner. So they're maximally spaced out because they contain like negative charges. Now back to oxygen. Oxygen is in the middle of that four-sided die. The four orbitals are at the four tips, the four corners. Two of those orbitals are full, and we don't really depict those in a picture of the molecule, but they're at two of those corners. The other two corners are where you have sharing, where the hydrogens are. And that's why that angle is the way it is, because of the geometry of a tetrahedron. And similarly, the simplest hydrocarbon, methane, has carbon in the middle, and then all four corners is a hydrogen. So it forms a tetrahedron, too, if you build a model of it. 18, I believe, is the final slide in this chapter. And here we are looking at a couple examples of signal molecules. Now, a signal molecule is a signal. Not all signals are molecular. But a signal molecule is a signal that... Well, it is a signal, first of all, because it causes something to happen in a cell that wouldn't happen without the presence of that signal. Signals change things. And as far as molecules are concerned, signal molecules, nothing is going to happen in a cell in response to a signal unless and until that signal molecule binds to the right kind of receptor. And if you think back to my example for positive feedback, what was that example? Parturition, yes. Remember, I was talking about oxytocin being released from the brain. The whole body receives the oxytocin because it's carried in the blood. But almost the whole body has no idea the oxytocin is there, because most of the cells of the body don't have receptors, which are proteins, these purple things, membrane-bound proteins, membrane-bound, not membrane-bounded. They're part of a membrane. Anyway, these proteins have to have the right shape to receive the complementary shape of the protein, of the signal molecule. Just like a lock and a key. Has to be the right shape to fit in there. Most of the cells in the body don't have receptors with the right shape for oxytocin, so they have no idea it's there, but the uterus does. That's true for signal molecules in general, though. Unless there is a receptor, and beyond that, unless that receptor binds, at least temporarily, to the signal, nothing will occur in response to the signal. Now, the signal in this case is an example of an even more general word called ligand. There's all kinds of different examples of ligands, and we'll talk about some eventually. It's a more general word than signal molecule, though. A ligand comes from a word meaning to tie, like ligature is something you tie surgically. To ligate means to tie or to bind. A ligand is just a particle that binds to a protein. And there's all kinds of examples of that, but a signal molecule is one example of a ligand. The reason I'm mentioning it now is that in all of the examples we'll talk about, there is something in common. When any ligand binds to a protein, the general consequence of that is that the protein will undergo a conformational change. The conformation of a protein is just another name for its shape. So, if a signal molecule does bind to a receptor, then the receptor protein will change its shape in response. And that's how the cell can react. It, something happens in the cell based on that shape change that wouldn't happen if the signal molecule were not there to change the shape. Now, the two example signal molecules we're seeing here are endorphin, as you see, and morphine. They are both signal molecules, but the endorphin on the left is an example of an endogenous signal. Gen, like in generate, means create, or in Genesis. Endo means inside or within. So endogenous means created within. We make in our bodies endorphin, and it acts as a signal molecule. The other one, though, morphine, is exogenous. And we give another name to exogenous signals, which is drugs. Drugs are exogenous signals. You have to deliver them to the body for them to have any effect. The reason they have effects, though, is for the same exact reason as for endogenous signals, namely because they can bind to a receptor of some type and cause something to happen. Well, in the case of endorphin and morphine, the effect is similar in both cases. Kind of a euphoria feeling for either endorphin occurring naturally in your body or morphine taken as a drug, despite being pretty drastically different in their molecular complexity, right? Endorphin is a lot bigger and more complex a molecule compared to morphine. But as you see by the receptor, it's not that whole shape that matters for the signal. It's only the part that actually fits into the corresponding shape of the receptor called the receptor site. Kind of a glove and a hand. And for morphine, the part, this boxed part of morphine is pretty damn similar to this part, which is the important part of endorphin. Therefore, the receptors that you have in your body that are there to receive natural endorphin can also receive morphine, giving you a similar effect because the shape change of the protein is going to be similar. Yeah?
So can you explain again what is
endogenous just means that it's created within the organism. It's occurring within. And exogenous is outside of the body, but it can be taken in. This is what drugs are. And this is how what pharmaceutical industries do to design their drugs. They study receptors, try to come up with molecules that can fit those receptors to either block our own signals so they have no effect, because the receptors will be busy just binding to these things that do nothing, or to mimic the effect of signals if we're not making adequate amounts of our own signals internally.
So, exo?
Yeah, exo means out.
Yeah, so it creates the outside by allowing...
Well, it just means that an exogenous signal is created by something else. It's not part of the body, and you have to put it into the body for it to work.
And that's why it allows...
That's why we call them drugs, because we don't make our own. We have to... They're artificial from our point of view. Okay, that is the chapter. Any final questions before I skip the switch to the recording? Yeah, ligand, real general term, is simply means some sort of particle that binds to a protein. And a signal molecule is simply one example of a ligand. There's all kinds of other examples we'll talk about later. But in general, whether it's a signal molecule or any other kind of ligand, if it binds to a protein, then the protein is going to undergo a shape change, a conformational change.